as I did on the back of that big, gaudy barge. I could feel the cold wind in my hair as we moved, we went so fast. It was exciting, and the scenery was gorgeous. Gilmore was just beginning to burst with greenery with the spring thaw, and trees were filling their branches with verdant foliage. A wet, earthy smell permeated the air, part rain and part river. When we called a four-hour halt that night, we had travelled well over 100 miles. Camp was a couple of fires sufficient to cook with, and some naps in the barge. Food was basic, some stew and some biscuit, for those who weren't too busy sleeping. To be honest, most of us had grabbed naps while we rode, and some had slept the whole way. But sleeping when there's no sensation of movement is more restful. The dogs got fed too. Huge slabs of beef and mutton we'd procured for the trip and I'd stored in magical pockets. The giant curs wolfed down the raw meat greedily. A few war magi went among them and cast spells on their aching paws. By midnight, they had caught their breath and were ready to push on. We didn't stop again until dawn, which found us 200 miles upriver and out of Gilmore by the map. We were in the Westlands region, a sparsely peopled land of small forests and rolling hills. The Poros had narrowed by a third at that point, and the stain of the goblin armies passing now covered the icy river from bank to bank.
"I can't believe they froze it solid," Taran said, shaking his head. "I suppose they had to bear the weight of all those worms. Have you seen the size of their droppings? They have to weigh tons. Freezing the surface, even for a few feet, wouldn't have supported that. They needed it frozen solid. Power they're expending on this spell is just unimaginable.
Some of it is coming from sacrificed human slaves, I reminded him. The sooner we can counter it, the slower they'll be slitting throats in the Umbra. He made a face.
You sure know how to take the intellectual intrigue out of something, don't you?
I'm impressed too, I admitted. It was clever, it was subtle, and it was simple. I'll be more impressed when I'm looking back on this day as an old man, talking about how we defeated it. How is our progress on that?
It's coming along,
he agreed cautiously. We've identified the location of the device they used. It is unfortunately at the bottom of the river, and they have a guard on it. We can work around that, I nodded. What about countering it?
It's still theoretical, he sighed. Gavani magic is strange. We don't have the same symbolic system. They're both derived from Alka-Alon magic, technically, but culture plays a large role in how we design our spells.
I could appreciate that from an intellectual angle. If they didn't find a practical solution, however, this really would become a suicide mission. Just find a way, I pleaded. A lot is riding on that horse.
I know,
he sighed. The good news is I've mastered your pocket stone, he grinned, handing the thing back to me. I put it into the special pouch I'd made for holding such treasures.
It's fascinating. Really unique. I've already thought of 100 thaumaturgical uses for it.
If you think that one was impressive, just wait until you try the big one, I assured him. Making elementals permanent has a real appeal. I felt something in my intestines lurch a bit. I guess I should take the opportunity for a constitutional and a pipe, I sighed. No telling when we'll stop next. I wandered off into the woods near the river, the bright morning sunshine cutting through the trees that had just decided to start sending out leaves for the spring. It didn't take long to find a secluded bush to do my business in, and while I was settling in and lighting my pipe, I tried to relax just the smallest bit.
"It's about time you were alone," a sharp female voice said, surprising me.
Before I could react, Brigga formed herself in the air in front of me.
I figured you would have enough sense to consult with me more than you have before you started this campaign.
I didn't happen to pass a temple along the way. I was suddenly very conscious of my position. One doesn't usually address the divine when one is taking a grunt in the woods. I've been preoccupied. That dream you sent had a lot of details to be worked out. She nodded, her perfect red hair glistening.
I know. It's still a long shot. But you've managed to pull it together better than I'd anticipated.
I grunted and exhaled a stream of smoke. I have a habit of making people underestimate me.
You are not the only player in the game, she reminded me sternly. Dragons are attacking the two greatest Alka-Alon strongholds in the realm. Anus Yatharel is holding out, thanks to the valiance of their warriors. but the dragons at Anthatiel have already attacked the gate fortress and are reducing it to rubble, and that army is only a dozen leagues away. They could be there in a few days. I know they got hung up on the Alka'alon's tricks and traps, but that won't delay them long. I'm aware of the pressing nature of the engagement, I answered, a little more sarcastically, and I'd hate for us to miss the chance to fight another dragon, or three. But, I continued a little more sternly, if you hadn't noticed, I've put thousands of people to work on this, and we've made significant progress, to the point where I'm now taking a crap in the woods instead of a chamber pot, because I actually do know how pressed for time we are.
Good, she answered simply.
See that you make it up the escarpment in the next 2 days, else you will not be able to catch them in time. We're doing the best we can, I said through clenched teeth. I needed to get the focus of the conversation away from her criticisms of my execution of her plan. It was a little hard to take. How do you like being permanent? I asked, catching her off guard with a change of subject. She blinked.
It's amazing, she admitted.
It's difficult to explain. When I first incarnate, I go through a short period of disorientation, as if I'm learning what it is to be a goddess for the very first time. Only now, she grinned, when I manifest, I recall exactly what and who I am from the first. Independent existence without the benefit of human agency. It's dreamy, she smiled.
But is it useful? I countered.
Well, of course, she agreed. I've been able to, well, there are still limits to what I can do, but I've gone ahead and done what I can to facilitate your attack.
Actually, we can probably handle the offense, I reasoned. What we really need is help lifting this spell. We just don't know enough about Ghavani magic, and there's a lot of interference from the shamans in the area, not to mention an army of 30,000 encamped next to the site. I've got good people working on it, but a little divine intervention might be useful.
I'll see what I can do,
the goddess pledged thoughtfully. I can hang around the magi you have working on it and see how far they've gotten.
You can do that, without them noticing, I asked, surprised. Wherever there is flame, I am there, she quoted from her liturgy. It takes some focus and concentration, but it allows me to see, well, whatever is lit by fire.
That must come in handy, I nodded, still self-conscious about my position, and not too certain how I could change it without offending even more profoundly.
It can be. It depends on the flame. That's why I couldn't just visit you before now. When you were alone, it was in darkness or by moonlight. I needed that, she said, nodding toward my smoldering pipe, to allow me to manifest.
Interesting. Well, go see if you can spare Pentandra and her crew some divine help. We'll be into the Scarred Lands soon, and ready to attack the goblin army after that. It would be nice if that spell was broken by then, if the dragons have left anything of the city.
Don't underestimate the power of the Alka'alon, she counseled. It is not infinite, nor even the most potent, but it is subtle and clever and powerful. Dragons are powerful, true, and three of them now battle against the Alka'alon at Anthatiel, but do not despair. They may be challenged, but they are not overmatched.
If the gods favor them, I said automatically. It was just an expression, but I hadn't counted on my company.
We mostly do,
Brigga agreed. Only a few of us hold grudges from the old days. In fact, when this is over, you may wish to consider applying your stone's magic to them, she said cautiously. A goddess was concerned with irritating me. While I took a crap, my personal universe was getting stranger and stranger.
It is certainly something worth investigating, I said diplomatically. If I survive this battle, and depending on its outcome, bringing order to the universe should be a bowl of porridge, I quipped.
Understood, Minilan. My blessings upon you. She faded from existence as I tried to respond. I sighed and realized I had just, for all practical purposes, taken a holy crap. It seemed fitting. The second day of travel saw the river narrow significantly. It was still wide enough for the barges, but they could no longer pass each other easily on the ice. We were also coming to the first major frozen cataract along the edge of the escarpment that led into the foothills, that led into the much wider country of the Alshari Wilderlands, the Scar Lands. Human habitations had already begun to thin, both in density and in number, as we went further upriver. But the villages and cots had not been spared the torch. The Gavani army had pillaged along both sides of the river as they had travelled. The wooden palisades that stood for protection in this corner of the kingdom were easy prey for the siege worms, and once the wooden walls were breached, there was no defending against the sheer number of Gavani. Those who tried paid the price, and had their corpses featured in one of the goblins' gruesome works of art. That first cataract, at Hounswell, marked the end of the easily navigable waters on the river in normal times. As a result, the trade that continued to the provincial domains even further upriver was serviced by a smaller class of boat, and the town's economy there was largely structured around shifting the freight from the lower part of the river to the upper, or back again. The goblins had not waited for the service. They razed the town, butchered the inhabitants, including devouring two entire boroughs of Talalon, and continued on their icy road with barely a pause to digest. The siege worms had no difficulty climbing over the rocks and boulders in their way, although some of their great carts, no doubt, had to be pulled over land. Nor had they left it unguarded, else it had become a haven for deserters. Several score Gavani infantry, of the poorest sort, attempted to attack our barge as it came into the frozen wharf. The war magi responded, and within minutes there was not a living goblin in sight. My arcane warriors had become more and more proficient in dealing out death at the point of a wand in the few years they'd had their witchstones. We did face a dilemma, however, how to get our barges over the road, around the boulders, and onto the upper portion of the river. It turned out that Taran had anticipated the problem, and with the help of the pocket stone, he had hit upon an elegant solution. After evacuating our barge to the last man, he took the weirwood rod he'd been working on and cast a spell. And the barge disappeared. Then he walked up the steps, through the ruined town and to the wharf on the upper end of the river. With a few more words, he caused the barge to reappear, intact, upon the ice. The river was actually quite wide, before the falls narrowed it again. We pushed the barge upriver and made camp in the ruins of an unfortunate inn, while we waited for the rest of the barges to be likewise transferred. It would take some time, and the dogs needed a few hours of rest anyway. It was an impressive bit of enchantment, and everyone was effusive with praise with the young thaumaturge, which took him by surprise. Even Onranyan was impressed by it, and immediately launched into a discussion with the man about the theory, after Taran taught the spell to Sarakim and let the archer do the transportation. It took several hours to transfer them all, but we needed to rest anyway. Nightfall was coming. As much as a bedroll in non-moving, unvibrating solid ground appealed to me, I had to spend the time staying appraised of the situation, ahead and behind us. Ahead of us, Captain Arborn had detailed swift-moving scouts to reconnoitre the territory ahead, abetted by scrying. In addition, the Falcons were able to cover a tremendous amount of territory, and were instrumental at picking out goblin stragglers or patrols. There were still raiding parties spreading out and looting the isolated manors and farmsteads in this remote region. This was the beginning of the Alshari Wilderlands, and they had a ways to go between each settlement. Roads were poor, and so were the hamlets they encountered. They seemed to be ignoring the river from which they'd arrived, however, so we left them to their pillage. Our fight was with the main army, and the dragons. That was the disturbing part of that evening's report. The three dragons attacking Anthatiel had been focused on destroying the gates and wrecking the beautiful residences along the cliffs and shorelines. When they ventured too near the city proper, however, they were pelted with magic that they could not ignore. But that didn't stop dragon fire, and the beasts had made several sweeps over the top of the city. It was burning now, in places, despite the magic of the treefolk. It was hard to put out a fire when the lake you depended upon for water was frozen. None of the three dragons had been challenged, much less defeated, by the Alka Alon, and the army had yet to arrive. If Lord Eratas and his people could not keep the dragons out, how could they defeat an army at the same time? The army itself was mounting the final ridge that led to the last plateau before the mountains began in earnest. It was gratifying to hear, through Ithalia, that the Alcan Lord had heeded one piece of my advice at least. The goblins were meeting stiff resistance to their advance over that last massive cataract from hundreds of Alcans, in natural and human-sized form alike. Ithalia was smugly proud when she related the thousands of Gavanni who had fallen already at the point. Unfortunately, as much as the resistance had delayed the column, it would not stop it. Already the Alcans' position was being flanked, and their magical defenses were under strong duress from the combined might of the Gavanni shaman's assault. By morning, the vanguard would overcome the defenders and continue relentlessly along the final leg of their campaign. The situation behind us was less complicated, but almost more worrisome. Count Salgo was preparing to redeploy his troops in Gilmora defensively, positioning them along the Poros to cut off the Gavanni raiders from their support from the north. At least that's what he told Rad, and that was reasonable enough. The raiders continued to play havoc with the countryside. Their depredations had the effect of pushing the effective war zone in Gilmora wider, into the south, west, and east, joining with the Gavanni who had been there a year and expanding the looting and raiding efforts. Salgo's move was, ostensibly, designed to intercept the returning columns of prisoners and keep the Gavanni from being resupplied and reinforced. Perfectly reasonable. The fact that this would allow Salgo to effectively support our operations was pure coincidence. The Prince Heir, Duke Tavard, was leading 40,000 mercenaries and levies slowly overland toward Gilmora to reinforce Salgo. This had the added benefit of sweeping away the Gavanni bands that got in their way, which was helpful, but not particularly useful, tactically. It was hoped that the approaching army would keep the 30,000 goblins encamped on the other side of the Poros from Gavard at bay. They hadn't realized that the Wedding Cake Castle was no longer infested with war magi yet, but once they did, they might try to take advantage of the supposed weakness. I spoke at length with Pentandra, mind to mind, who was in her element coordinating the effort to unfreeze the river. She had the greatest minds in magic at command, a reconnaissance team of war magi in the field, providing accurate intelligence about the device, and a deadline she could not miss. Power, control, a mission worthy of her talents. This was Pentandra at her best, and I hated I could not be there in person to witness it. She assured me that they were getting closer. Every few hours there would be a new development, a new breakthrough, a new approach with promising indications. They just weren't there quite yet. The stress and exasperation in her mental voice was complemented by an excitement and drive I'd rarely seen in her. She had been pushing papers for the order for 2 years or more now, and this was the most exciting thing she'd done outside of help fight a dragon. I assured her I had every confidence in her, knowing that Brigger planned on giving her a little nocturnal inspirational push that night. I was itching to tell someone about the divine visitation during my constitutional, for the sheer humor value, if nothing else, and Pentandra was a natural confidant. Yet in the middle of a war was not really the best place to bring up practical theology. We'd talk later. Lastly, I spent a few precious moments using the mirror to speak to Alia and let her know I was alive. It was the usual mix of thankfulness and anxiety, worry and relief, with a little extra longing for home. Perhaps it was masochistic of me to indulge in that kind of magic, for I'm certain Alia was a weeping wreck for a while after our conversation, and I was not doing too well myself. But what man would not want a few last words with his beloved on the eve of battle? As painful as it was, the pain of regret over failing to do it would have been much worse. When I finished with my intelligence gathering and filial duties, I wiped my eyes, tapped out my pipe, and headed back to the camp amid the ruins of Hounswell. There were several fires going, and I found a large and homey one nearby the lead barge. Sarakim was roasting sausages, and someone had put on a big pot of soup. I looked around at the heaps of giant dogs who had collapsed into sleep after devouring their rations. The remaining rooftops were filled with keen-eyed Kasari rangers and Alka Alon archers. There were war magi patrolling the perimeter of the camp, and there wasn't a goblin in sight. We were safe, for the moment. I could relax. But how could I tell my body and mind that? "Are you feeling ready for battle now?" Spellmonger Sarakim asked me slyly, as the hot fat crackled on the surface of his smoking sausage. "Does a goddess manifest in the woods?" I replied, boldly glancing at the fire. If Briggo was really present in every flame, she heard me. "Line the dragons up! I'm ready. We'll be there in 2 more days if we keep travelling like this. I wasn't planning on taking the barges this far, but from what I understand, thanks to Taran's trick, we might be able to take them all the way to the gates of the city." I yawned and warmed my hands in front of the fire. It was chilly here up in the frontiers of the Wilderlands. There were still pockets of snow in the hills, but the foliage was starting to burst forth. I loved the smell of the air up here. Ramdahl slipped beside me and forced a bowl of thick mutton stew into my hands. "Eat, master," he urged. "You haven't had anything in hours." "Here," Tyndall said, opening a wineskin on my other side. "A couple of sips of this would do you right." "What's the matter?" I asked curiously. "You haven't been eating, master," Tyndall reported solemnly. "You may not have noticed, but we did. Nor sleeping but for a few hours. We know you're busy, and so much depends on you, but if you don't take a few moments for yourself, well, Lady Alia would kill us both." "My lady does have a temper," Rondell agreed. "Best you eat the stew and avoid any unpleasantness." I looked from one to the other and realized that they'd coordinated this effort. Of course they had, I reasoned. They were just being good apprentices, looking after their master. I put a spoonful of mutton in my mouth and chewed. It was tough and chewy, and the accompanying potatoes were a bit mealy. There were onions and a few herbs in the lumpy, starchy broth. No better than peasant fare. It tasted exquisite. "Point taken," I said, taking a swallow of wine. Good wine, I realized, far better than the mutton deserved. "You do know we have a couple of hard days' travel ahead of us, and then a ferocious battle at the end." "You thought we came for the food?" Rondell asked, pointedly, as he picked up his own bowl. "Yes, master, we understand what's at stake here. We've been talking about it. If the Gavanni capture Amthatiel, it would make the war incalculably more difficult. Our allies would be wounded, our flank vulnerable, and it would open up a new front in the war when we can barely contain the ones we have now." That's actually a pretty accurate summary," I admitted, continuing to eat. I was suddenly famished. "The dragons are going to be the problem, you realize." "The dragons are a problem," Rondell agreed seriously. "Everyone's worried about them. We've been talking about what spells they can throw at them. I'd rather avoid them altogether, if you want to know the truth." "Dragons are a pisser," Tyndall agreed conversationally, "but they do get the girls. You start talking about Castle Cambrian and being there when the Dragon Slayer and the Hawk Maiden slew the beast, and the skirts just start flying up. I'm hoping 3 dragons has an augmented effect. It's nice to see you have some future purpose than just slaying 3 dragons," I said, rolling my eyes. "I want to keep it interesting," he shrugged. "Otherwise it's just work." I looked at both of them, one to the other and then back again. "You also realize," I said slowly, washing the mediocre mutton from my mouth with the superior wine, "that we are in all likelihood going to die in the very near future. That this is a complete suicide mission. That your hopes of ever seeing a girl again with all of your limbs intact are virtually nothing." Tyndall looked at Rondell, and there may have been some mind-to-mind communication between the two. Tyndall ended up speaking for them both, by apparent agreement. "Speak for yourself, master," the arrogant young knight mage smirked. "You can die if you want, but that would interfere in our plans. That includes a dragon skin rug for our castle and a couple of very grateful Alcaalon maidens." I blinked. That was a cocky statement, even from Tyndall. I looked over at Rondell. "Is that your plan, too?"
"The not dying?"
"Yes, I think it would be premature. We haven't even taken our exams yet, and I have things to do." Even my more stolid apprentice was sounding unusually confident about our chances. I was about to speak when Dara bounded into camp, grabbed the spoonful of stew out of the pot, and collapsed in a heap at my feet while licking the spoon, all in one smooth motion.
"Just bury me here,"
she begged with adolescent exaggeration.
I'm not flying again until I get some sleep.
What about you, Dara? I asked, as she made obscene noises about the flavor of the food. Do you think we'll come out alive from the battle? Your fellows seem to think that we have a chance against three dragons, an army, and the magic of the dead god.
She cocked an eyebrow at me. You really want to know what I think?
Surprisingly, yes, I decided.
I think this is the most powerful group of high magi ever assembled. They are looking forward to the fight, and I'm sure we'll come out of the battle alive.
You are? I asked, surprised.
Me?
She asked.
I definitely will. So will Frightful. I'll be hundreds of feet overhead, watching you poor bastards below. If things get ugly, I can fly away to someplace warm and cozy.
You guys? You might be dead, but don't worry about me.
Thanks for your confidence, Rondal said sarcastically. Tyndall just looked hurt.
Dara looked up, stew smeared on her lips.
Don't blame me, she said, rolling her eyes. I'm not stupid enough to take on a dragon head on.
Luckily, we're just stupid enough, Tyndall said, clearly not thinking through the implications of his response.
We're ready to be a dragon's bad day.
I hope you're right, I sighed, wondering at the marvelous stupidity of youth. This battle just has the potential to go all sorts of nasty ways once we get there.
I worry, I confessed.
Don't,
Rondal said unexpectedly.
We can handle ourselves. If you want to worry, worry about the poor dragons.
Chapter 32 The Dragon at the Gate. I peered out at the ruined gates of Anthatiel through mage sight, magnifying my vision by 100 times, until it felt as if I was standing directly below them. That would have been a very poor idea. The place was infested with goblins. I was just as happy that I was a half mile away, concealed by a blind and a thick layer of concealment spells. The gates were huge, of course, as I had noted when I'd seen them from afar from the city proper. The towers that bore them were truly massive, 15 stories high, each one attached to one of the 2 cliff sides that made up the entrance to the high mountain lake, or the exit of the water from that lake in a gorgeously dramatic cataract over magnificent boulders, all frozen now in mid-splash. It had taken 4 days total to cross the rugged wilderlands known as the Land of Scars from our last camp at Hounswell. 4 long, exhausting days the goblins had used to their best advantage. I hadn't intended on taking that long. The farther up the river we went, the closer to the army we got, and such a massive army sheds deserters and subsidiary units like a wet dog does fleas. We kept running into opposition, mostly lightly armed bands of deserting infantry or patrols of cavalry, but 2 times the cataracts were defended by proper infantry. It took a little time and bloodshed to sort them out, but we barely even used magic. The Kasari Rangers were deadly fighters, silent and stealthy, and their bows were very accurate. It only took 30 minutes before we could start to magically portage the barges. The journey had been further complicated by weather and mishap, and once a pitched battle with 1,000 Gervan infantry unit who stumbled across our camp during a patrol. We defended against them easily, but the attack wasted almost an entire day's travel. But we finally broke through the penultimate level of escarpment before the Great Lake. We were in sight of the enemy's rear guard, which had taken residence in the gatehouse fortress, what was left of it. The northeast, right-hand tower had been demolished, leaving only a barren, burnt, rocky stump of a foundation. The massive steel gate was rent from its hinges and flung onto the ice. The rubble that remained of the tower was shelter for a few 1,000 goblins who didn't seem to have anything better to do. I could also see a few siege worms lumbering about, battle castles strapped to their broad backs. The left-hand tower, to the southwest, wasn't destroyed. It was occupied. Whatever defenders the Alka Alon had left there had been driven out or killed. Some dark banner of red and black flew over the place now. The battlements swarmed with little black shapes, and more worms were chained to its base. But that wasn't the problem. The dragon was the problem. Beyond the ruins of the left-hand gatehouse, I could see the back and sides of a large, dark bronze-colored dragon, its wings folded over its back.
It had apparently been the one responsible for the damaged architecture, and we'd have to get past the beast to attack the Gavanni.
"Duin's hairy sack," swore the outlaw, as he took stock of the situation. "They don't want to intimidate us, do they?"
"Look at the size of that thing," breathed Talaman, who insisted on coming. As our tactical leader, he had an interest in assessing the situation.
"That's at least another 20 feet longer than the one at Cambrian."
"It's older," reasoned the outlaw. "It's had more time to grow. It's a year more mature. And if they keep growing at that rate..."
"That's why we need to stunt their growth now," I agreed. "Permanently.
Look, he's not alone either. Goblins own that tower now. They've got complete coverage of anything trying to cross the ice. Even if we could transport the barges up here, we'll be right under their noses."
"Then we'll just have to take the tower,"
Terlaman nodded. "And then have the dragon to contend with,"
Bendenal the outlaw pointed out.
"You see what he did to yon tower?"
"I didn't say it would be easy," Talaman said tersely.
"That's not the only issue," I added. "Look at the base of the ruins. There's at least a couple of thousand scrugs there, mostly infantry, and they have a couple of pet worms."
"Trying to get through them is going to be a job of work,"
Bendenal the outlaw observed conversationally as he calculated the strength of our foes.
"How do we do it, then, Commander?"
He meant the question teasingly, but he didn't know Terlaman very well. The War Mage considered the situation with professional expertise, surpassing most military commanders. The job, to Terlaman, was never impossible, just challenging.
"Three teams," Terlaman decided, "one to take the tower by stealth. Kasari and the Alka Alon, I think. They'll know the terrain the best. They can go up the frozen cataracts," he pointed out. The 50-foot field of boulders, the size of castles that was the route of the Poros, had been sculpted by the advancing Gavanni army. Instead of taking the circuitous footpath from the Alcan Marina at the base of the falls, the goblins used magic and trolls bearing mighty mattocks to hew massive steps in the ice. Blood was smeared on the steps, indicating a healthy resistance. But after the dragon destroyed the gate, there was little the Alka Alon could do but fall back.
"Second team to take the goblins on the northeast side amidst the rubble of the second tower," he decided, after another moment's thought.
"Won't that alert the dragon?" I asked, alarmed.
"I'm counting on it," Talaman pronounced. "That's where the third team comes into play. That's the dragon-killing team."
"And you want them to attract the dragon?"
the outlaw asked doubtfully.
"Yes," Talaman affirmed. "If the dragon stays where he is, he can flame the entire pass without exposing more than his snout. He's protected by the cliffs and the rubble. We get him on top of that rubble, every mage in the pass will be able to target him."
"And what about all the goblins and siege worms in the way?" I asked.
"What's going to happen when the goblins are pressed really hard by war magi?"
he asked in return.
"They're going to fall back," conceded Bendenal.
"Toward the dragon? Up a mountain of rubble?"
"No," Talaman continued in a reasonable tone of voice. "They're going to retreat back toward their once secure fortification in the region."
"The other tower," the outlaw supplied, "which will be packed with Kasari and Alka Alon by then."
"Exactly," Talaman agreed. "We get the goblins out of the way, have them get taken by surprise volleys from their erstwhile friendly fortification, whilst we engage the dragon.
Putting us at the bottom of a huge mountain of rock and stone, with a ferocious killing machine staring down at us," finished Bendenal skeptically.
"We'll have him right where we want him," assured Talaman.
"I just love it when a suicide pact comes together," agreed the outlaw grimly. We made our way carefully down the rocky trail we'd used to find the vantage point. The landscape abounded with them. I could see why it was called the Land of Scars. Thousands of years of rain and wind had not softened the geological chaos that had happened in the distant past. The hills were twisted and toppled. Rocks jutted forth at odd angles and in weird formations, and the only reasonably flat ground was near the diminished boroughs. That's where we made our camp.
The Alca'alon had built a small marina on a sandy spit near the pool at the base of the cataract for the infrequent times they went forth by boat. The installation was savaged by the Gavani as they passed by, but the ruins made a perfect staging area for our surprise attack. We brought the barges further up the river than we'd anticipated. Taran's trick of using a massive magical pocket had virtually eliminated the need to portage the massive, gaudy boats, either magically or through more traditional means. He had refined the technique 2 days before, after talking to Onranyan, and had linked the arcane interdimensional space he was using to a second rod of werewood, allowing both to access the space. After that, instead of removing the barge at one point, climbing around obstacles and then re-manifesting itself at another, two men could do the job much quicker. The first would load the pocket with the barge, using one rod, while the other would unload it a moment later with the other. It was a brilliant innovation. 19 of the boats made it. One had been left behind at the base of the escarpment in case of retreat. I didn't like thinking that way, but then again, retreat was one of many, many possible outcomes of the battle ahead. I wanted to plan for that. The rest were beached at the marina, and the 3,000 men, Alcans and dogs, ate, slept, and prepared for battle under cover of powerful obscuring spells. The Gavani of the rearguard had a few shamans, but they were unlikely to be scrying vigilantly. Still, we wanted as much of the element of surprise as we could muster. We discussed the plan in far more detail on the hour-long hike back to the barges. We considered many scenarios and strategies, and by the time we walked into camp, we had the entire plan figured out sufficiently to start giving orders and explaining the battle plan. I was surprised at the enthusiasm I saw in return, but I should have known better. Even though we'd spent the better part of a week riding along the ice and climbing through the tortuous landscape, the war magi did not seem weary in the slightest. The Alca'alon positively shivered with the excitement of battle, and the Kasari treated their mission as just another exercise. Get 1,000 men and 1,000 Alca'alon into a guarded fortification without alerting a nearby army? When do you want them there? Then there's the dragon, I said to the large group of unit commanders and interested spectators I'd gathered around the largest bonfire on the beach. The dragon is the key to this battle. Don't forget, we have two more to face when we're done with this one, so don't waste anything. But we won't be facing them until this one is out of the way. I want the falcons to play a part in this, I said, looking at Dara's sprawled form. Her 3 skyriders were standing around her, a boy and 2 Tal'alon. At this point, they were veterans. Us? Dara asked, her eyes shooting open. Fight a dragon? Harass a dragon, I corrected. We're going to be preparing mighty spells below. Just keep him busy while we're doing it. Distract him, I ordered. Distract a dragon, she said in disbelief. With my girlish allure. Master Min, my birds are tough, but they aren't dragon tough. Use your imagination, I counseled. Like I said, you just have to keep his concentration split. Surely you can manage something annoying? The challenge hung in the air and my apprentice looked back at me thoughtfully. Then she sighed. Do you care what we use to do that? She asked. Sing him a jaunty tune for all I care, I shrugged. Just keep him from flaming the rest of us while we're preparing to destroy him. And try to have fun, I added sarcastically. The rest of the 3rd team will be comprised of Sire Kay, Mage Lords Wenick, Taran, and 10 more volunteers. I continued. Anyone who has a good idea about how to kill a dragon, now is the time to experiment. How far away is the main force from the gate? Asked someone from the back. Do we have to worry about reinforcements? No, Dara said before I could speak. I flew over there this morning. The main army is concentrated around the city on the Big Island. That's a couple of miles away over the ice. They have it entirely besieged. One of the dragons is there. The other is on the north wall, destroying some buildings and gardens along the cliff base there. So, we'll have a short time before someone notices a 1/3 reduction in the dragon population and sends an army after us. God's willing, I said, glancing at the fire, we'll be already underway long before they can get here. When are we attacking? Someone else asked.
Lance of Boon, I think. Dawn, Telemann said curtly. The Kasari will go in a few hours before, to set up their assault. The rest of us will take the footpath on the north side up the escarpment. They haven't bothered guarding it. We can gather below the rise to their first outpost and go over at first light. We attack with the rising sun. Not that it will do much, but it will keep the sun at our backs and in their eyes during the first wave of the attack. I can't see how that would hurt us. It also gives us plenty of time to rest up, sharpen our swords, hang our spells, fill our quivers, and make our peace with our lives. I still haven't any positive word on the counterspell. A lot still depends on that. We could have a total victory in the morn and see defeat by nightfall, if they don't come up with something. That, I said, speaking loudly enough for all to hear, is out of our control. All we have to deal with is one dragon. Three dragons, someone corrected from the shadows. There was a wave of nervous giggles. One dragon at a time, I corrected. That's our part. We can do it. Now, everyone, get some sleep and some food. Busy day tomorrow. As everyone broke up to prepare for their part in the battle, I noticed Dara borrowing one of the transport rods from Taran. I was about to ask him what she wanted with it when I was grabbed by Mage Lord Thinrattle, of all people. Spellmonger, he began politely. I thought I'd mention something that might be important. I think the Ghavani are, in fact, searching for Korbol's lost tomb, and I think they are not the only ones. What? I asked, confused. About 3 years ago, more like four now, when I was first appointed as the ducal court wizard, there were several gentlemen, he said, using the term with obvious distaste, who had presumed on their connections at court to propose just such an expedition into the wild reaches of the Alshari Wilderlands. This very region, in fact. Surely you got that sort of thing all the time, I dismissed. Yes, yes, of course, the former bureaucrat reported, but these men were different somehow. Less prone to flights of fancy and more interested in gold. They wanted the support of the court. But I knew the late Duke Lengwin would never sanction such wild chases at the coronet's expense. But they were quite well prepared with maps, citations from legend, and historical documents that they said proved that Korbal's final resting place was within these hills. That's fascinating, but I don't see how it matters at the moment, I admitted. All of the small parties we've run across along the way up the river tends to indicate to me that Shurul is just as interested in that tomb as those men were. Further, it is possible that the two are linked somehow, he proposed thoughtfully. Why would the Ghavani be interested in an old human legend of a demon god, I asked, particularly when it appears to be a half-remembered legend of a renegade Alka Alon? Yes, that is a good question, agreed Thinrattle. What the men who approached me assured was that Korbal could raise legions of the dead to fight Alshar's wars, should we discover the tomb, that he had a hidden fortress stocked with magical wonders, and, of course, mounds of gold. There always seemed to be mounds of gold involved in that sort of thing. That could be important, I agreed. Thanks. Keep me posted if you recall anything else like that. Korbal the demon god. There was more to that than met the eye, I could tell. There were many plots and plans emanating from the Umbra, and it was clear that the goblins were getting at least some aid from disaffected Alka Alon traitors. Perhaps Korbal fitted into that somehow. Camp was quiet and tense that night, as we all prepared. The dogs got some much-needed rest, and our men were able to limber up and properly prepare for the assault. I got some sleep in the barge with two oversized hunting dogs on either side of me. It was warm and cozy, but the big mutts had bad breath. And gas. Rondel and Lorcus woke me by starlight a few hours later. As I gulped down bacon and a cold biscuit, they told me the Kasari and Alka Alon had already departed camp. The war magi would start up the trail toward the outpost within the hour. I splashed water on my face, peed, stretched, and secured my armor. Spells were hung soon thereafter. I was ready. as ready as I ever am to face mortal danger. We trooped single file up that narrow, rocky trail, our footfalls, coughs and cleared throats concealed by powerful spells. The stealthy vanguard silently eliminated the lone pickets and patrols with bow and knife. The small outpost, no more than a score of Givani, was unprepared for the attack. But when first light broke over the far horizon and illuminated the rocky camp, we screamed our war cries and leapt up the path, swords singing and spells blazing. There was little determined resistance, so total was their surprise. Within seconds of our first blow, the camp was swarming with war magi tracking through blood and black hair. The next outpost along the path was larger, but no less vulnerable to the near 100 war magi who launched themselves at the primitive barricade. These scrugs had the time to raise their arms, but not the strength to defend against such powerful spells and determined attackers. Rondol and Tyndall were among the first inside the Givani lines, and the boys plied their mage blades and war wands like madmen against them. "Nice," Lorcus remarked, as Rondol sent a goblin sprawling headless with a sharp, determined blow. "How far until the next checkpoint?" "Less than a quarter mile," I said, as the last of the defenders were put down. "That's got a garrison of at least 200 light infantry. After that, it gets challenging."
200? The Ramiran asked, cocking an eyebrow. "Maybe I'll actually get to wet my blade this time."
The next outpost apparently had word of the incursion, and half of the troops were lining up to go investigate when we fell upon them. Indeed, Lorcus wet his blade in the furious but brief action as we overwhelmed them in formation. He also got to use some wider area spells against the confused rush of Givani, including a spectacular flare that set a few of them on fire. But that was the last small group to contend with before the main section of the rear guard. We abandoned stealth at that point because our foes had been alerted. The main camp was coming alive as news of the attack spread. We moved forward until we found the best places for concealment we could, as closest to their lines as possible. We were helped in this by the terrain. Apart from the smooth-worn Alcan path, the rest of the landscape was littered with convenient rocks and boulders.
"Dear gods, this place is hell on the ankles. Hold up, Min, I've got a nasty spell I want to try," wheezed Wenick,
when we were in position, nearly 200 yards away from their makeshift camp amid the tower's ruins.
"Can you give me a few minutes?"
"At your convenience," I decided. There are few war magi who understand offensive magics better than Wenick. He took up the challenge of wide-area offensive spells with vigor, once he'd gotten a witchstone, though he rarely had the opportunity to try them out in the field. Huffing and puffing in his large coat of plates, he began summoning runes and casting spells to raise power and channel energies. It was impressive to watch. An arcane ball of force built in front of him. It grew in size and intensity for several long minutes as he poured power into it lavishly. Finally, he opened his eyes.
"Everyone take cover," he ordered. "As soon as this goes off, every hell you've ever imagined will break loose."
We hunkered down behind anything offering a hint of shelter. Wenick's facility with hurtful magic was gaining a reputation. The rotund mage hurled the sphere into the air, and it immediately sped off at his direction until it was directly over the center of the goblin's camp. Then it winked a bright flare of piercing white light. Wenick's prediction was understated. What followed was the biggest and most dramatic shift in emotion I've ever witnessed. Every goblin in the camp, at least 1,000 of them, began to wail and scream. Some began running away in no particular direction. Others took up arms and began hacking at their fellows. Still others cowered on the ground with their hands over their ears. Wenick grinned in professional satisfaction at the chaos.
"What the hell did you do?" demanded Lorcus. "Berserker spells?"
Wenick looked offended.
"Try pure existential terror."
"Beg pardon?" Lorcus asked, confused.
"Every goblin affected is in mortal terror," he reasoned. "He fears for his life at an abstract level. Everything he sees and senses is a threat to his existence."
"That seems a little subtle for most, Gervani," Lorcus said doubtfully.
"Not when Shurul is using that terror to keep them in line," he countered.
Normally, that existential terror is coupled with the transactional understanding of the consequences of disobedience, and is checked enough for them to be useful by that reasoning. I just removed that bit of reasoning. He chuckled. They all feel the terror now, but not the conditioning they've had to contend with it and make it useful. You made the goblins afraid? I asked skeptically. I figured you'd go for something more painful.
Look at the result, Wenwick said dismissively.
The goblins were attacking and running and hiding and moaning in piteous terror. Not all were affected, but enough were so that order and discipline were shattered.
That should make attacking them easier.
They still outnumber us by 10 to 1 or more, Lorca said uncomfortably.
10 to 1 with 9 out of the 10 weeping, withering wrecks, Wenwick countered gruffly. Use high display spells, sonic spells, harsh language. Tell them they ain't pretty, whatever. You just give them a reason to run and they'll run. Promise.
You are one devious bastard, Lorcus conceded a few minutes later, as the chaos turned to carnage in the camp.
I like that.
Are we ready? He asked, drawing his mage blade. Wenwick picked up the big mace he favored and nodded.
Charge!
I ordered, manifesting Blizzard's halberd blade. We jumped from behind our hiding places and ran into the mass of terror-stricken goblins. As predicted, as the lead elements of our assault plowed into the disorganized mass, the goblins began taking to their heels or lying prostrate on the ground. The rest was a bloody mess. War Magi charged into the mess, firing war wands and stabbing wildly with their blades. The more noise they made, the more the regiment resembled a terrified mob. In 5 minutes of heavy fighting, mostly us hitting them, the entire group of them began screaming and running toward the apparent safety of the tower across the frozen river, where their comrades might protect them. It was gratifying, a few dozen of us screaming and yelling and chasing goblins over the short cliff down to the ice. Their terror-laden expressions fed the sadistic thrill of it. I couldn't help amplifying the occasion magically, using select spells to make myself seem even more fearsome in appearance than I was. Ordinarily, a shaman's protection would keep such flimsy spells from being effective on the battlefield, but I didn't feel a lot of defensive magic up around me. We routed them. The fleeing goblins ran for their lives, leaving their shields and weapons behind them in their haste. That was unfortunate for them, for as soon as they crossed the narrow shelf of ice and came to the southern bank of the frozen river, they were mowed down by the adept bows of the Kasari Rangers and the incredible archery of the Alka Alon. You could hear their screams of abject terror and despair across the ice as the morning sun lit the pass completely. Their screams carried well in the morning air, and we were not the only ones to hear them. We had gained the day, it seemed, and there was just the one last... I could feel it in my chest before I heard it. The roar was so loud and all-consuming. Lungs the size of sailing ships propelled a massive growl of anger and defiance from the dragon's maw, and we felt every massive footfall the beast made as it came to investigate what was disturbing his slumber.
"Stand ready!" Telemann shouted from behind me.
I saw Sire Kay raise his dragon-hide shield and grip his hammer. Wenwick furiously cast defensive spells on himself. Rundell began spinning a wand in his hand, his purpose unknown, his eyes set on the top of the 5-story-high pile of rubble that had succumbed to the dragon's claws. All around me the war magi prepared. The designated specialists marched to the front of the rank as the first great claw came into sight, grasping the top of the pile and pulling upward. As stones fell and were scattered, the other claw arrived, and in seconds the tremendous head was lifted above the crest of the pile. Another bellow came, this one even more enraged as it surveyed the scene. That one made my teeth vibrate.
"Ready!"
Telemann ordered, raising his own big mage blade to signal. I reached out to Dara, mind to mind.
"It's time for my lady's big entrance," I reminded her. "Try not to get yourself killed."
"I'm just a distraction, remember?" chided my youngest apprentice. "Just how much do you want him distracted?"
"Can you get him to keep his neck up?" I inquired. "That's where we hit the last one. They seem a little weaker there."
I think I can try something,"
she promised. Bide. I watched in fascination as the great dragon's head, the size of a tournament pavilion, cleared the summit, and his huge eyes turned downward. To us. That's when six small shapes darted out of the sky and began swarming around the beast's head. The falcons dogged the dragon like a pack of circling dogs. Only four had sky riders. The other two were being controlled by beastmasters. It was almost impossible to tell which of the six were being ridden at this distance without mage sight, and I could not spare the attention at the moment. But the birds dived on the Saurian head with elegant ferocity. It took a moment for the beast to realize it was being attacked from the air, but when it did, it wasted no time scrambling up the pile of rubble in an attempt to get at the flying irritants. It moved fast when aroused, I noted with horror, much faster than I'd anticipated. Its head poked up into the air so suddenly the giant falcons were forced to swerve to avoid it, and one nearly lost some tail feathers to a lightning-quick snap. I hoped that wasn't Dara. I saw a quick streak fly from one of the birds toward the big black eyes, and that's when I saw it. I wasn't sure at first, and so I quickly summoned mage sight, regardless of the distraction it implied. I saw something that made my blood freeze as cold as the porous below. Around the neck of the dragon, I saw, as I amplified the image, was an immense iron chain that seemed dainty only by comparison to the neck it encircled. Amid the black iron links were cages holding something white. Snowstone. Each wrought iron enclosure bounded a boulder of snowstone. That was how Sherul was deploying the dragon so neatly, I realized. The snowstone lowered the magic resistance of the beasts just enough to allow spells of control. My home was furnishing the enemy's most lethal weapon. Before I could assess just what that might mean for the battle at hand, the Sky Riders lined up in formation and began another run at the dragon's darting head, coming in from a very steep angle. A collision course with its head, I realized belatedly. Lance after lance shot forth from the graceful falcons as their riders loosed sky bolts, metal javelins hurled at great speed. Utterly ineffectual on a dragon, of course, unless you were lucky enough to pierce its great eye. None of the Sky Riders, it seemed, were that lucky. Dara, pull up, I ordered, mind to mind, as I saw my apprentice recklessly keep on course, long after her javelin, they called them sky bolts, bounced harmlessly from an eyelid. The beast was drawing back, its eyes on the airborne threat. It was inhaling, I realized with grim terror, and when it exhaled, my noble experiment in aerial warfare would plummet to the ground, fully cooked. Dara didn't answer me. My fear consumed my stomach as I watched her dive unwavering into the dragon's maw. "Hey, Wenek!" Sarakim called from behind me. "Have you anything that would make the dragon question his role in the universe?" he joked nervously, as we awaited fiery death. Before I could utter the word to attack, Dara answered all our questions at once. Suddenly a rock, nearly as large as Frightful's big body, materialized in the air, falling at the same speed and in the same direction as Frightful. Dara pulled her aerial steed up hundreds of feet shy of the dragon, but the rock continued on its way. A moment later it hit the right side of the dragon's face, smacking it into the side of the cliff and producing a sharp double impact. The great beast collapsed under the shuddering impact of the blow and fell limp over the mountain of debris. The side of its face was crushed and bloodied, though its great limbs still twitched alarmingly. "Or she could just do that," Sarakim said, a little anticlimactically, as a cloud of dust flew from the force of the dragon's fall. Chapter 33 The Battle of the Red Ice. I stood gape-jawed as I watched my youngest apprentice land her fearsome bird neatly on a rock, 20 feet away. She was sliding off the harness and unfastening her leathern helmet as she descended, her red hair tossing free in the breeze.
"I did it!" she was screaming excitedly. "I did it!"
What did you do?" I asked, bewildered, though no less happy for it. "Dara, what the hell did you do?"
"It was easy.
I remember Taran talking about how the pocket stone's capacity was a function of mass, she began, and he proved that with how easily he moved the barges, once he'd created the interdimensional space to do so and anchored it in the rod. Then he made a second access through the other rod. I was thinking that the only realistic way I could clobber a dragon was to get all my birds to drop a barge on him, and that was just stupid.